grabbed the arms, grabbed the legs of Jack Richmond. They pulled him. The district court found there's evidence that one or more deputies knelt on Jack Richmond's back. The district court found that Jack Richmond gasped for air, complained of pain, and stated he could not breathe. Those are the core facts that the district court found.
Well, don't we also have to assume that there was bad blood between him and the police?
Well, our position is that the district court didn't take the next step. It found those things, but it didn't examine the gratuitousness, didn't look at...
I don't see how you're answering my question.
I'm sorry.
Don't we have to assume that there was bad blood between Richmond and the police?
I don't think so, Judge, because the bad blood that the district court cites to, we submit, is we're not arguing sufficiency. We're arguing that it is absolutely irrelevant. The bad blood.
So you're accepting that there was bad blood, that we have to assume there was bad blood between the police.
No,
now you're confusing me. I thought you were insisting that the Eighth Amendment standard applied.
Yes.
The Eighth Amendment standard has a mental state element in it. One could say, if the Fourth Amendment standard applied, that bad blood is irrelevant because the Fourth Amendment standard is objective. But you're arguing for the Eighth Amendment, and therefore you make the officer's mental state relevant.
I do. But this is... Please let me draw this distinction. What the district court found was animosity...
The district court didn't find anything. This is summary judgment.
District court considered animosity in the community at large as evidence of the bad blood. There was no evidence that any of the individual deputies harbored any type of malice, ill will. The district court looked at, because...
The question is, you put everything together. Record. You put the bad blood together with the 14 cops jumping on this pathetic creature. And the question is, could an inference be drawn that this was a deliberate or reckless use of excessive force?
Well, Judge, not because this gentleman is an activist in the community, we draw the inference that these particular individuals possess the ill will.
That's not all that's in the case.
No, it's not. And what's in the case
is... So now you're making a kind of jury argument in which you're saying to the jury, surely just the bad blood, that couldn't be enough, and surely just the 14 jumping on him couldn't be enough. But of course, your opponent would say, yeah, but you put these things together, and you're beginning to get, a basis for an inference of deliberate use of excessive force or, punishment without due process.
The district court didn't look at the how.
An unusual punishment.
The district court didn't look at the how, the what, and the why of the actions.
I don't think one can look at the what's and the whys in any event on summary judgment. One takes the evidence and the inferences in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
And
putting it all together is the jury task.
But it was...
I don't understand why, if you want to get bad inferences about mental states out of the case, you're not arguing for the Fourth Amendment standard.
Well, I
don't understand why your adversary is not arguing for the Fourth Amendment standard here. I'll ask him that, too.
Well, I've cited some cases that use Fourth Amendment, and that is a lower standard. My clients benefit from the Eighth Amendment, which is a higher standard, which requires the mental state.
I don't know which is higher and lower. I do know they're different. One of them has scienter in it, and one doesn't.
And even if you use the lower standard, the objective reasonableness standard, their actions were objectively reasonable. We see that in the Phillips versus Milwaukee case.
I understand. So you have this person, you know, 489 pounds, and of course, in one sense, that makes him formidable. But clearly, no, he's in terrible physical shape. He has to be removed from the courtroom somehow. But to have a whole this whole squad jumping on him, that
it seems very
seem
odd. You have somebody who's 500 pounds. You treat him like a bear and spray him with a can of bear spray.
Well, they didn't all jump on him at one time. In fact, and this it goes to the. It illustrates what I would submit as a cursory.
The first two couldn't do anything. The rest piled on.
Well, there were.
There doesn't seem to be any recognition, despite what Judge Easterbrook said, that this is not a healthy. I mean, this obviously is not a 480. Do we know how tall he was?
I don't know how tall, but there was nothing that indicated he had a bad heart.
This is the nth case in which a party makes something of the weight of a witness or a litigant, and they never tell us what the height is. But 489 pounds is gross obesity, and people who are suffering, who have that, are not in great shape normally. He walks with a cane and so on, has trouble walking. So they have to treat him with a modicum of consideration, seems to me.
Well, that's why he was first asked.
It's not as if he's endangering people, right? I mean, of course, he's obstructing the court. He has to be removed. But it's not as if he's attacking someone, holding on to the podium. I mean, they should sit back and, you know, think a little about how do you remove this guy.
I'd like to address the 14-deputy issue, Judge, because the degree of contact varied wildly. One of the female deputies, Maura Weirich.
Yes, I know, but look, you can't have a swarm and then say, oh, well, you know, 100 people jumped on him and they smothered him. But we don't know which of the 100 was the critical the malefactor.
We have deputies that grabbed his arm and then let go. That's it. They were denied summary judgment. As I said, there's very limited contact. We don't have mind to examine. We don't identify any specific misconduct.
Well, you can't with this swarm, right? As I say, suppose you have 100 people jump on him, so he smothers. Then you say, well, we can't attribute his death to any one of the 100, so they all go free. They all. And immunized. That doesn't make sense.
Well, that's not the case here, though. The deputies, they were
that's
all
That's your interpretation of the case.
Well,
you can't pin it on any one of the 14.
You can pin specific acts to specific deputies, absolutely. The only thing which you really can't pin is somebody kneeling on him, but I submit that doesn't matter because there were no injuries. Even if somebody did kneel on him, we're accepting that.
It's very strange. No injuries. He dies, right? Dies. That's an injury.
Well,
and of course, if he's smothered, you don't necessarily have any marks on someone when he smothers, right?
That's not why he expired. He expired because of hypertensive cardiovascular disease. He had a bad heart.
You don't expire because of hypertension. You don't expire because of coronary artery disease. You expire if the coronary artery disease precipitates a heart attack, right?
Which it did. His heart was in such a bad condition, the medical examiner testified a cold shower could have killed him.
Yeah, but look, haven't you heard of the... Oh, come on. Haven't you heard of the eggshell skull rule in tort? You take your victim as you find him. And if you... If you attack someone, hit someone in a way that wouldn't seriously injure a normal person, but this person has a glass jaw or something, you injure him, you're fully liable. So his pre-existing terrible health was a factor in his dying, but I don't see how that exonerates the defendants.
I submit it's different in this Eighth Amendment context because The deputies didn't know.
Suppose they decide, we're going to punish this prisoner. We don't like this guy. We're going to punish him without going through the formalities. But we're going to punish him for his contempt, right? We're not satisfied with 120 days, so we're going to beat him up. They don't think they're killing him, but he dies, right? So they're liable. That's cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, that's almost res ipsa loquitur, Your Honor. I'm going to ask to reserve the rest of my time.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Pekus. Mr. Namon.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I think the Court's questions to counsel and counsel's answers make very clear, at least to us, that this is a Johnson v. Jones kind of a case. This is a case in which the defendants are arguing evidentiary insufficiency, and this
I'm
case...
I'm interested, actually, in what you're arguing. Your pitch in the district court was based on the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness standard.
Yes.
And, of course, that was also the argument in the first appeal to this court, and the panel assumed that this situation was governed by the Fourth Amendment. And now you seem to have abandoned the Fourth Amendment. What's going on?
We have not abandoned it at all. In fact,
your brief doesn't talk about the Fourth Amendment.
The procedural posture of the case is that the defendants are appealing from the district court's denial of their summary judgment qualified immunity motion.
And you could defend the judgment in your favor by relying on the Fourth Amendment. But as this case has been briefed, if we agree with the defendants on the meaning of the Eighth Amendment, we will reverse and your case will be over. So why does your brief not address the Fourth Amendment?
Because that issue is not part of any kind of final judgment. The defendants here are appealing through interlocutorily.
Did you hear me?
Yes.
If we agree with the defendants on the Eighth Amendment, we will reverse and this case will be over.
Ah.
You will never have any other opportunity to argue the Fourth Amendment.
We would respectfully disagree because this case would be remanded.
It won't be remanded. It will be reversed, and the case will be over.
Your Honor, I think we did not have an appeal as of right on the Fourth Amendment issue. It might have been an issue of pent in appellate jurisdiction or a cross-appeal, but that would have been discretionary, and a strategic decision was made.
You don't need an appeal or a cross-appeal. You can defend a judgment in your favor on any ground that has been preserved in the district court. That's how it's done.
Well, don't give up so quickly.
I'm not giving up, Your Honor.
You did say in your brief, plaintiff continues to maintain that the Fourth Amendment supplies the proper standard for this claim. Now, you didn't argue it. But you cited a case, and you said from the beginning plaintiff has maintained the plaintiff's violated Fourth Amendment right.
We even argued law of the case before the district court with respect to...
But it would be more prudent, in our view, that repeated arguments.
Well, I'm prepared to argue it in the alternative, either way the court wants, with respect even to the more difficult, from the plaintiff's perspective, Eighth Amendment argument. It seems to us that it's very clear that taking the evidence in a posture most favorable to the plaintiffs, which I think is the proper procedural posture here, contrary to what the defendants are arguing, there is more than enough evidence.
But isn't the Fourth Amendment more a more plausible basis for your case? Because it's a little odd to think that these swarming deputies were trying to punish him for his contempt, right? I mean, it all happens simultaneously. The contempt is the sanction. The judge just wants Richmond out of there.
I agree, because, among other things, what we're doing is enforcing, the defendants were enforcing, a court order. There was no confinement in this case, and the reasons... The policy justifications for an Eighth Amendment standard are not really applicable in this case because we are not in a prison situation. In fact, the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which is obviously not before this court, would not define or include Jack Richmond as a prisoner subject to its strictures. So in our review,
punished outside of a prison.
I'm lost now. The Eighth Amendment plainly applies outside of prisons. Suppose Richmond had walked out and allowed to to walk out because it's too dangerous to stop him. And the judge issues a bench warrant for his arrest because he's just been sentenced to 120 days in prison. And the police go and arrest him, and he submits quietly, so there's no excessive force used in making the arrest. They put him in the paddy wagon, and in the paddy wagon they beat him in order to administer the punishment for the crime of contempt. That beating, I assume, would be covered by the Eighth Amendment because he was in custody.
I think
your argument here, I take it, is that they were trying to take him into custody, and therefore it's the fourth within the domain of the Fourth Amendment.
That's correct.
But
and the standard
paddy wagon is not a prison under the Prison Litigation Reform Act.
In any event, I'll withdraw my reliance solely on the Prison Litigation Reform Act, but nevertheless maintain that this is a Fourth Amendment case, or even if it's an Eighth Amendment case, the defendants ought to lose, and the district court's decision denying summary judgment ought to be affirmed. Are there questions about the Eighth Amendment issue or failure to intervene? Because there are many facts contrary to what the defendants were arguing with respect to the record in the case.
Well, what about the deputy who had his hand in a cast? Was that a had some kind of weakness in his hand? So when he grabbed it at Richmond, he couldn't hold him, and according to what your opponent said, he couldn't have been a precipitant of the death or other harm because he just sort of grabbed ineffectually with his...
Your Honor, our theory with respect to the Eighth Amendment and the alternative, the Fourth Amendment, is joint and several liability. And what you need for that is a group of actors who either consecutively or concurrently cause a single indivisible
injury.
Yes,
but did this first person who just grabbed at Richmond, did he contribute at all to an injury or punishment or
well,
whatever?
Well, if in fact what we've got is a single indivisible injury here, the answer with respect
to
all...
No, you can have a single indivisible injury. That doesn't mean that everybody in the world is the injurer. What if you had a deputy who was just standing there, who didn't do anything and didn't command or condone? He's just watching.
Well, in that situation, that's our second argument with respect to those who may not have touched Jack Richmond, and that is the failure to intervene. This court long ago set out in Byrd versus Brischke that there is a due process duty to intervene to prevent constitutional violations by law enforcement officers
and
prison
guards. Well,
no, that would
be true. If you have somebody in custody and, you know, one prisoner is beating up another, and you know about this, you're the guard, you know about it, you could prevent it, and so on. You don't. Now you have a duty there, but that's because you're in control of the environment of these people. But if a deputy is just standing in the courtroom watching, he doesn't have. I don't think he has a constitutional duty to intervene because he doesn't have any control over the defendant.
Your Honor.
I
understand your question. Our response is that the duty to intervene does not inevitably require physical intervention. It would have been useful.
But that's the form of the intervention. I'm saying there's no constitutional duty just because you're a public officer to intervene to protect people whom you do not control in some way, right?
The Byrd v. Brischke duty applies not only at the supervisory level on down, but it applies
to
co-equals as well.
No, but you have some control over the... You know, like the police take the keys out of the ignition and someone is exposed to marauders or something, right? But in this case, if you just have a deputy standing there, he's not doing anything. He's not. There's no causal relationship between him and the... Dilemma of Richmond.
Yeah, suppose there's a sexual, improper sexual environment where at the police station a woman is harassed by a male officer. Is your position it violates the Constitution for the other male officers not to rush to her defense?
If they have a realistic opportunity, if they are present and they have a realistic...
You know, the Supreme Court has had a very different view of the obligations of co-workers.
Well, with respect to the substantive due process affirmative duty issue, if you're thinking of DeShaney, this is not a DeShaney case.
No, but the principle is the same. There's generally no duty of rescue on the part of public officers under the Constitution.
Correct.
You have to have more. The fact they could rescue effortlessly is not enough. That might have been, you know, true in DeShaney. So
these defendants are all involved in swarming. All 14.
So that's critical to your position.
Oh, it's critical. They're involved in the swarming. They're involved in the incident. They are present. We're not insisting that any one of them individually had a duty to intervene physically. As this court, I believe, has pointed out, even oral statements or warnings might be enough. Go slowly. Be careful. What are you doing to this man?
No, but you're missing the point. You just talk about the mode of the intervention. You're not talking about the ground for saying that their failure. Oh, I'm sorry. You're just talking about the swarmers, what the swarmers could have done. Okay.
Right.
Retract my question.
They are there. And even for those whose conduct in touching Jack Richmond might not have contributed to his death, although we argue that if you take the case, the inferences in our favor, as we're required to do at this point, they could all be deemed to have contributed to his death. But even our alternative argument is the failure to intervene with respect to those who may have touched and those who did not touch. And this court pointed out in the Abdullahi case a little bit ago that failure to intervene issues are almost always for the jury because they involve factual disputes about whether there was indeed a realistic opportunity to intervene.
How should they have removed him from the courtroom?
Your Honor, this was at the very end of a call, as you know from reading the briefs.
Now, that's not my question. How should they have removed him? Should they have just left him there?
They should have isolated him. They should have tried to call
him
down.
What does isolate him mean? What's you talking about?
Clear the courtroom. That was a possibility.
So they just leave him alone in the courtroom, so this courtroom is no longer usable.
Not at all, Your Honor. I'm not an expert on these things, but among other things, you referred earlier to the bad blood with respect to the North.
This is not a bad blood issue. The question is, what should they have done concretely? Excessive force, if we think in Fourth Amendment terms, is relative to the circumstances. Right? What is excessive in one situation isn't in another. So what do you do?
These defendants were trained in something called a force matrix.
I understand that. What should they have done?
Well,
can't you be concrete?
They should not have grabbed him immediately.
I know not what they shouldn't have done, what they should have done.
They should have surrounded him first. They should have talked with him second, because they knew from past experience.
Okay, what do they do third?
Then you touch and say, hey, calm down.
What's fourth?
Fourth in the matrix is something referred to as intermediate weapons. That may be a mace or something of that sort, which was Judge Easterbrook's suggestion a while back. And the last one is lethal force. And these defendants jump to.
You can't use lethal force to remove a person from a courtroom.
Of course not.
That's ridiculous.
But the use of.
Are you conceding that if he was still fighting after they had sprayed pepper at him, they could just shoot him dead?
Not at all. Not if he's no danger to anybody at all.
It's you yourself who said lethal force.
You said lethal force.
No, that was. I was describing the use of force matrix.
Lethal force, except it can't be lethal.
I was describing the use of force matrix in which
they were. Should they have done, right? I mean, just think about it. What should they have done in a situation like this?
As I said, surround him.
Follow this ridiculous matrix. Right.
Well, I think you mean they should have used mace or a taser.
Sorry, Your Honor?
They should have used mace or a taser, is what you're saying. I think that's what you're saying.
That was one possibility, but I'm not sure they should have used that at the outset.
That's two possibilities.
Yeah. Because it was at the end of the call. There was no danger to anybody else there, and instead they swarmed him. And not only did they swarm him, but there is contemporaneous language.
Police frequently confront this in demonstration situations where the demonstrator goes limp. So the police must have methods for removing either limp bodies or resisting bodies, even when they're very large, right? So it would help, although not essential, but it would help to have a sense of how you think a responsible police force deals with this 500-pound fellow who is clutching the podium. Mm-hmm. They do have to remove him eventually, right? Just leave them in forever.
Well, by way of example, there was a North Shore mosquito abatement district hearing sometime before the events in question. You referred to the bad blood earlier. And Jack Richmond became very strident. My time is up. May I finish responding to this?
Briefly,
he became very strident, and one of the defendants in this case actually talked him down at that point, and they stopped the meeting cold. Everybody left, and they calmed him down, and there was no need to use any force at all.
Okay. They should have been more patient.
Much more patient. Infinitely more patient.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope not
infinitely
more patient. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Pekas?
What the deputies did was measured. It was a slow escalation. The judge ordered.
How long did it take from beginning to end?
The entire incident, from the time the judge hit the panic button to the time the ambulance was called, was only 7 minutes.
No, you're not. You said that they acted in a slow, measured way. My question is, how long between when they first confronted him, the deputies, and when he died? How long was that?
They came behind him.
Look, would you answer my question? I didn't ask you what direction they came from. I asked you a simple question. How many minutes intervene between when they confront him and when he dies?
All I can say is less than seven. Somewhere less than seven.
And why do you think that less than seven is an example of slow, measured response? It sounds fast.
Well, because when you look at the situation they were confronted with, a judge saying, go with the sheriff, let's go, no, let's go, no. Then the judge incrementally, the judge said, if you don't go with the sheriff, you're getting 30 days. Did he go with the sheriff? No, that's when he grabs the podium.
I don't understand what you're talking about. Why is 7 minutes slow and measured?
Because they didn't come up to him and crack him in the head. They didn't come up to him.
Look,
and
7 minutes is longer than 1 minute. I agree with you.
They didn't mace him. They measured.
7 minutes is, but why didn't they take 15 minutes to talk to him? Presumably he does calm down, judging from the previous incident.
They have a judge saying, get him in there. Get him in there. That's what they're faced with. That's the situation they were confronted with. That's the gray area. That's why they're entitled to qualified immunity.
The judge, during this, left. He left. Left the room.
That's not his testimony.
So now we're going to argue about the facts, right?
I'm not arguing that. I'm not arguing that.
So we have to assume that he left the room during the altercation, right?
After he said, get him in there.
Look, you answer me.
Yes.
Yes. We have to assume that he left in the middle.
Yes.
So what did he say to the police? Get him out of here.
Get him in there.
Because I'm coming back.
Now you're getting 60 days. Get him in there.
Ah, forget.
Now you're getting 120 days.
You don't understand.
Judge, I'd like to just briefly, Judge Posner, address what the court asked regarding the eggshell plaintiff. We can't look at it that way in this case. We have to look at what the officers were confronted with at the time. And Justice O'Connor...
It's a tort case. The eggshell skull rule is general tort law. I'm sure part of constitutional tort law. So why isn't it?
Well, Well, I think we're playing Monday morning quarterback. You have to look at...
No, that's... Look, you don't understand... You must not understand the eggshell or thin skull rule. It is Monday morning quarterback in the sense that you are liable for assaulting a person who has a vulnerability that you're completely ignorant of. No one would have suspected that you... You know, the Bosberg versus Putney, you kick one kid... one kid kicks another. It turns out the kid he's kicked has some terrible infection in his leg, so it's a horrible injury. The child who did the kicking had no reason to think that he was kicking a vulnerable person. Nevertheless, he's fully liable. That's the rule.
I'd ask to make one final point, that the state of the law in 1997, 3 months before Judge Ripple authored Phillips versus Milwaukee, in that opinion, Judge Ripple wrote that the officers...
Counsel, opinions speak for the court. Well, if you're speaking of a dissenting opinion, then it might speak for a single judge, but I assume you're not relying on a dissent.
I apologize. The court...
I think your time has expired.
Thank you.
Case is taken under advisement. We'll